Is it, is it ready? Perfect. Awesome. Hi, everyone. Good evening, and thank you for joining us for the Magnolia Public Schools Board of Directors meeting. My name is Jennifer Lara, and I am the Executive Assistant. This will be my first time facilitating, so I am super excited. Before we begin, I did have two brief reminders. One, this meeting is being recorded. And two, if you're a member of the public and would like to give a comment during the public comments portion of this meeting, you're more than welcome to state your name. If you are not comfortable, you do not have to state your name. To the members of our board and staff, please state your name before speaking. So now let's begin Magnolia Public Schools Board of Directors meeting. The day is October 8th, 2020, and the time is 6:09 p.m. Rabbi Beliak, may you please call the meeting to order?
Ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, cats and jammers, the Magnolia Board School meeting is being called to order. And I want to remind everyone that we're recording our meeting. And the first order of business is that we're going to take roll. Please, Jennifer.
Thank you, Rabbi Beliak. I will now take roll. Rabbi Beliak?
Yes.
Dr. Yapanil? Dr. Dickbush? Ms. Gonzalez?
Yes.
Ms. Covarrubia?
Here.
Mr. Mohamedov?
Here.
Perfect. Thank you. We have quorum. Oh.
Thank you.
Sorry. Dr. Dickbush, are you on the line?
Yes. Good evening, everybody.
Hi, Dr. Dickbush.
How are things in San Diego?
Not as hot as LA.
Okay. So we have taken attendance, and now we'd like to invite attention to the agenda.
Yes, thank you, Rabbi Beliak. So next, we're going to move on to the approval of the agenda. So the motion is to approve the agenda as presented with the removal of action item 2A, elections of board members to Magnolia Properties Management, Inc. This will be brought up at a later meeting. Would a board member like to move the motion?
I'll go ahead and move the motion. It's Diane Gonzalez.
And I'll second it, Covarrubias.
Okay, thank you, Ms. Gonzalez and Ms. Covarrubias. I will now take vote. Rabbi Beliak?
Yes.
Dr. Yapanil? Sorry, he's not here. Dr. Dickbush?
Yes.
Ms. Gonzalez?
Yes.
Ms. Covarrubia?
Yes.
Mr. Mohamedov?
Yes.
Perfect. Thank you. The agenda has been approved as amended. Next is the public comments. As a reminder, public members are given 3 minutes to state their comments, 6 minutes if translation is needed. Does anyone from the public have a comment? No? Okay, thank you. Next, we have announcements from our CEO and superintendent, Mr. Rubalcaba.
Good evening, Magnolia board members, family, community, and guest. I wanted to give all of you an update regarding what's happening in Magnolia currently. So I'm going to turn it over to Jennifer Wade to give you an update on our COVID-19 happenings. Go for it, Jennifer.
Good evening, everyone. My name is Jennifer Hook. I am the Accountability Executive Assistant. So these are the updates as of October 8th. So I updated those figures for where the counties stand. They're still in the same tiers. As you can see, there has been a slight increase in LA County and OC in the new COVID cases per 100,000 people, and in the adjusted case rate. The positivity rate has remained the same in LA County. And in OC, it's gone up by like 0.1%. San Diego, they show a slight increase in the new COVID cases and a decrease in the adjusted and positivity rate of about like 0.4, 0.2%. Next slide. So the California Department of Public Health has added a new metric. They added the health equity metric, and it's just to make sure that counties are taking into account the most in need population. So in order to advance to the next less restrictive tier, depending on its size, a county will need to meet an equity metric and or demonstrate target investments to eliminate disparities in levels of transmission. And this new metric comes into effect October 6th, which was earlier this week. Next slide. There aren't many changes to the local counties. I do want to point out that both MSA 1 and MSA 7 are officially on the LA County lists of schools that are reopening for small cohorts. And I took that little screenshot there. And then if we go to the next slide. So MSA 1, 7, and Santa Ana are currently open for small group instruction. Santa Ana announced that they'll be opening for hybrid November 2nd. For TK through second grade only. MSA 6 is working on being able to open for small group instruction, and then co-located and sole occupancy sites are waiting for more guidance from LAUSD, while San Diego is working with San Diego Unified to open for small group instruction. And today we actually met our LA County Department of Public Health liaison, and we're able to do a walkthrough with him and MSA 7, and that went very, very well. So some good things to hear. Alfredo, did you have any additional comments?
Yes, thank you, Jennifer. And for those of you that don't know, Jennifer Suat and Patrick started this process of visiting school sites to check, to ensure that we were meeting all our health and safety practices as prescribed by our health and safety protocol, which again captures all the different health officer orders from the state to the local county. So I just want to give them props for all of the work they've done, and also the school sites who have been working very hard to reopen our schools. And as Jennifer said, we have three schools already doing one-on-one assessments for our English language learners and our students with disabilities. One thing that we forgot to add here is the fact that we did make the collective decision to keep our LA schools and our San Diego school in distance learning all the way up till December 18th. We will reevaluate those schools, nine schools, at the December 1st kind of marker to see what we want to do next when it comes to hybrid learning or to continue with distance learning. And also on the piece from LAUSD, we are going to have a meeting with them, hopefully within the next week, to learn more about their testing and contact tracing program. So then we could either opt in or be able to provide something equivalent to their program, which will then allow us to also offer these one-on-one assessments for our English language learners and students with disabilities. So we'll keep the board posted. So with that, I'll open it up to any questions, board members.
I do have a question about the date, December 1st, as the evaluation date. Simply because it's right after we've come back from Thanksgiving and right before we'll begin the winter holidays. And I'm wondering if we're gonna end up being able to do the December 18th opening because we're I assume that we would close somewhere around December 25th, and I'm not sure what that would look like in terms of our school calendar. I guess we're just simply ignoring holidays, or how are we handling that?
That's a great question. So let me add more specificity. So yes, for the LA schools, when I, you know, do say that they're going to be closed till 12/18, December 18th, that would be the last day of their first semester, which means that they would not come back until the second semester, which I believe is January 11th. And then for San Diego, December 18th is the end. Basically, that's the last day before winter break. But for San Diego, their semester doesn't end till, I believe it's January 22nd. So for them, if we did come back in January, it would be about the same time as LA. So yes, so this decision pretty much puts us with a possibility of coming back in a hybrid fashion January 11th. For all of the nine schools I just mentioned. Does that answer your question?
It does, and it kind of, you know, be in my mind, without, you know, no one knows, of course, what the precise data will look like, but the sequence of a Thanksgiving weekend where people are likely to be traveling and exposing themselves more to potential different people that they're not potted with, and then immediately to come back after the winter holidays, January 11th, which means that essentially what we're saying to people is that what they do on like January, on December 26th, which would be, I guess, 2 weeks, will be sort of critical to what's going to happen if we open on January 11th with at least more presence. Am I understanding that correctly?
Yeah, no, definitely. We're very mindful of what the experts are saying in terms of the flu season, how that kind of will impact COVID. And what we do on a week-to-week basis is the COVID team at the home office, including the school sites, we do jump on the phone with the public health officials. LA has their telebriefing every Thursday or Friday. Sometimes they change it up, but Dr. Barbara Furr, she gives us an update on how things are looking in LA and what's to be expected. And then for San Diego County Office of Education, we do have Erdinch jumping on those calls, and GoCon as well. And then with anything coming from the state, from the California Department of Public Health, we're on those phone calls. We're now calling the county directly on any matter that comes before us or any gray area specific to the guidance. And that's something we're also preparing for, how to not only mitigate the spread of the disease, but how do we also ensure that our families are, you know, getting the flu shot and being very mindful of some of the things you just spoke about, you know, because we know that this is the first time we've ever been in uncharted water. And how that looks, no one knows. And as Jennifer mentioned, there's been an uptick in LA, and that's over 2 weeks. And then Santa Ana as well, and San Diego also had an uptick. So in October is the official start of flu season. So we will see. We will monitor it. And it's almost the thing I've learned, it's almost the day-to-day thing. How you monitor things and kind of act nimbly when, you know, to be nimble, to be able to respond to that.
Thank you.
Alfredo, I have a question. This is Sandra. Have you guys received any guidelines from the state regarding the new foundings about it being airborne and close rooms, how it's lingering longer when it's with certain amount of space regarding that? Like, I'm concerned, like, with our staff that are, like, in our offices.
We have received guidance on, you know, ventilation, air filtration from the county and also the state. I'll turn it over to Patrick, since he's leading that department, in terms of kind of what we're getting, from what directives we're getting, specific to, things lately from the California Department of Public Health. I haven't seen anything. I know the CDC just recently did provide more guidance on, you know, the virus and how, you know, through this mechanism of being an aerosol traveling. But I haven't seen anything specific from the state. But I'll turn it to Patrick just to talk about the ventilation filtration within the office spaces and indoor.
Thank you.
Hi, this is Patrick, Director of Facilities. So, yes, I mean, the guidance has been fairly consistent as far as minimizing the number of people in closed spaces. The state, I believe, came down with, you know, not having more than, I think it's 14 persons in a classroom. And I think they capped overall occupancy at, I think it's 10%, if I'm not mistaken. But aside from that, what we've done is all of our private sites, you know, for which we're responsible, we are adding MERV 13 filters, which are, you know, pretty much the highest filter rating that you can get, the most efficient, filter out the most particles. And we're not only doing that, we're also making sure that our equipment is being serviced instead of a quarterly basis on a bi-monthly basis. So our HVAC systems are going to be very efficient. They're going to be well serviced. So we're really happy that that's moving forward. Aside from that, the campuses that are able to, where they might not have a brand new HVAC unit, we are advising them to the greatest extent possible to open up doors, open windows. If there's any question, to also purchase and install air filters, you know, the portable kind. So we're taking all the steps necessary to make sure that our staff and our students are, you know, are protective. And, you know, we're closely monitoring all the guidance that's coming out from, you know, all levels, and we're acting accordingly. So happy to answer any other questions you might have.
Ms. Covarrubias, this is Suet.
Yes.
Yes, I think I understood what you meant. There was an error on CDC's website about this diseases being transmitted on airborne, actually, conditions. They, I believe last week they changed it and they said it is possible to be airborne, and they stated actually certain situations that this can happen. I mean, airborne transmission of the disease. But this didn't change actually LACO and other guidelines, because they already told actually to replace all the filters with MERV 13 and other actually that Patrick is talking about. So the guidelines that we received has not changed, because they already actually covered it 5 months ago. I hope this
explains.
Yeah.
And then I'm assuming that every staff member is supposed to wear a mask while they're in the school properties?
Yes. At this point, yes. Yes.
That's embedded in our health and safety policy that you as a board, and our IPP policy you as a board have approved twice.
Yes.
So who's in charge of making sure that these staff members are wearing their mask?
Each school has a what we call a COVID-19 compliance team, which consists of the principal and admin team members. So the chief compliance officer at the school site is the principal. But the COVID-19 compliance team, they ensure that all the practices, health and safety, that are reflected in our policy are being implemented at the school site. And that includes monitoring masks, monitoring PPE, things of that nature. And then at the home office, we have our COVID-19 compliance team as well, which is about 8 members from Patrick to myself, Suad or Dinch, David and Jennifer, Brenda, Dr. Lopez, Dr. Callahan, Daria, our director of HR. So there's quite a few of us. So whenever there is any type of issue, we work together to obviously come with a solution. But the person at the school site is the chief compliance officer and the liaison to the county health department, which is the principal.
So can you guys please make sure that somebody's making sure that the principals are fine, are being compliant as well, to make sure that the staff are wearing their mask? I'm just going to leave it as that, please.
All right. Yo, no, definitely. Thank you for that feedback. And we have a call not only on Monday to discuss health and safety, but then we have a standing call every Wednesday where we do go through these protocols. And we work as a team. Whenever there is an issue or whenever we have to problem solve something, we are working as a team. But definitely thank you for the feedback, and we will work with the sites to make sure everything's good.
Yes, please. Thank you.
Other questions?
Thank you.
All right. So I'll turn it back over to Jen. Go ahead, Jen.
Thank you, Mr. Rubalcaba and Jennifer, for presenting. So next on the agenda, we have approval of minutes. This is from our regular MPS board meeting for September 24th and regular board meeting for September 10th. Would a board member like to move this motion?
So moved.
I'll second it.
Thank you so much. I'll take vote. For the one who moved first, Rabbi, and the second who motioned, Ms. Gonzalez. So I'll take vote. Rabbi Beliak?
Yes.
Dr. Digbush?
Yes.
Ms. Gonzalez?
Yes.
Ms. Covarrubias?
Yes.
Mr. Mohamedov?
Yes.
Perfect. Thank you. Now we'll move on to our action items. Oh, sorry, I forgot to mention. The minutes have been approved for both September 24th and September 10th. So with that, now we'll move on to our action items. We'll move straight to 2B since 2A has been tabled. So action item 2B, approval of HR administrator position for MPS home office. Ms. Hashmirza, Director of Human Resources, will be discussing this item. Ms. Hashmirza?
Daria, if you allow me just to give a quick narrative before I turn it over to you.
Yep.
So, board members, as you granted me on July 23rd, the authority to, you know, ensure that as we reopen our schools, that we're making sure that we are, you know, have the best interest of our students, staff, and families and community. And at the beginning of the year, it was asked, you know, do we foresee any changes to the budget, any changes that we will need to make? And that has happened in the sense of the amount of work required for us not only to monitor and oversee our wellness checks and temperature screenings to now us embarking in this testing of students, you know, staff and families. This has obviously taken on extra work, which our wonderful HR director, Daria, has taken on to lead this effort, not only when working with the school sites to address any you know, issues when it comes to any of our community having symptoms or any of our community members having COVID, working with the school sites, and we obviously meet and discuss these items. But now that we're embarking on testing and tracing and working with the district and then ourselves implementing our own surveillance testing, you know, it's taken up quite a bit of Daria's time. And with that, I know that in order for us to be effective, we do need extra support. And that's why I did take the action to promote Barbara into the HR administrator position, which, you know, from a year back, about a year and a half, we were planning to do before the pandemic hit. But now it is critical that we do have more support in HR to ensure that, you know, all these things are being done correctly. So with that, I'll just turn it over to Daria just to talk a little bit more about the technical side, about you know, bringing Barbara to the HR, and consistent again with what we, what you as a board approved when you gave me authority, is that any of these actions I take, we would bring it at the next board meeting for you to ratify it as a board. So, Daria?
Yes, thank you, Alfredo, for that introduction and the background. So, just like our CEO mentioned, you know, we are serving, the home office HR department is serving 370 employees, and we have one HR manager and one HR director, myself. And with the HR administrator, and some of the duties, as you'll see in the report, besides the COVID, the additional COVID-19 task, which currently, you know, Barbara is doing the testing, helping me with the testing, and then also will be helping with the all, following up on the county health orders. She will be also assisting me on the recruitment process, you know, assisting the job postings, screening application, and administering all pre-employment requirements and the processes, and then all the related paperwork. Sorry, I think there's a background noise. I apologize if you can't hear me. And then also, we also want to focus on and kind of streamline our recruitment process. And with that, we are planning, hopefully, when things back to normal, attending job fairs and do that networking, be the liaison between various recruitment channels. And also, like I mentioned, she will be assisting with the COVID contact tracing and surveilling testing.
And thank you, Daria.
With the budget piece, I think this, I can leave that up to the team, to our CFO.
Yes, I'll just chime in. But thank you, Daria, for that little bit more granular level of information. So yes, we would be using our reserve to bring on Barbara to this position, which she's already doing. She's doing very good, great work. And then obviously Jennifer, who's now taking her position and leading and facilitating this meeting. So with that, I open it up to any questions board members might have.
Before that, can we take any public comments for this item? Perfect. Board, do you have any comments or questions regarding this item?
This is Nick Khan. I have a comment. I think this is a great choice, and I truly believe that Barbara will continue doing a great job. And Jennifer, welcome again. I think this is a great team, of course, along with Daria, all of whom mentioned have been with Magnolia for a while and know the culture and are able to transfer that to new people like Jennifer. So good luck to everyone. I'm excited about this.
Thank you, Mr. Mohammedville. Thank you. For minutes purposes, I did want to add that Dr. Yapano joined us at 6:35. Hey, Dr. Yapano.
Hello, everyone. Sorry, I was late.
Welcome, welcome. We're just writing Barbara's promotion. We're very happy indeed. Dr. Yapano, we also voted a raise to all the staff that's on, and sorry you're late to vote.
Okay, late to the party. Okay, thank you.
Do we need a motion?
Yes, if there's no further comments or questions regarding this, would any of our board members like to move this motion? Sorry, and the motion is to approve that the board ratifies the actions of the Magnolia CEO to approve a human resources administrator position to the Magnolia Public Schools Home Office.
So moved.
Rabbi Belia moved. Is there a second?
Diane Gonzalez seconded.
Thank you, Ms. Gonzalez. So with that, I'll take vote. Rabbi Belia?
Yes.
Dr. Dickbusch?
Yes.
Ms. Gonzalez?
Yes.
Ms. Covarrubia?
Yes.
Mr. Mohamedov?
Yes.
Perfect. Dr. Yabunov?
Yes.
Awesome. So it's a unanimous vote. All six of our board members voted yes. So this motion carries. So thank you. That's the end of our action items. Next, we have our information and discussion items. We have item 3A, MPS School Annual Authorizer Oversight Reports. Our Chief Accountability Officer, Mr. Yilmaz, will be presenting this item. Mr. Yilmaz?
Good evening, board members and the Magnolia community. We just received the oversight visit reports from Los Angeles County Office of Education for our MSA 1, 2, 3, and 5, our four schools authorized by the county. As you know, the three schools, MSA 1, 2, and 3, are going through renewal next school year. Therefore, these oversight reports are especially important this time. I tried to include some summary and recommendations from the reports we got on this board cover page. LACO provides us with three kinds of reports. One is for the governance review, second for the fiscal annual report, and third for the instructional program. So I would like to ask Mr. Volkova to present the summary and recommendations on the governance review, followed by, you know, Mr. Orozo for the fiscal part and Mr. Rajar for the instruction.
Thank you, David.
Scroll through the board report, Jen, as they present. Go ahead, Alfred.
Thank you, David. So yes, board members, I just want to congratulate not only you, Barbara, and everyone whose hard work has created a great system for our board. As you know, LAUSD did give us a 4 when it comes to governance. And although LACO doesn't grade us in terms of us meeting all the markers when it comes to organizational management, capacity, composition, structure, clarity, meetings, parent and staff involvement, they said we did meet all the compliance requirements. And although we only had 6, you know, now we only have 6 members, they do see that, you know, we work together as a team to ensure that we're discussing things thoroughly, and we're making sure we're making, you know, the decisions on with the best interest in mind of our students and families. So a couple of things that they did mention as recommendations are that they still want us to continue to recruit new board members from the local communities, from our schools. So that is work that we're currently still working on to continue to do that. They want us to keep, you know, the board fresh when it comes to our student suspension and expulsion and due process, for which is being presented today by Dr. Lopez. They want us to continue to receive Brown Act training, which we do. And then they want us to continue to, you know, still have as many of our board members come in person. Obviously, right now, because of COVID, that can't happen. But overall, it was a very good report when it comes to governance. And obviously, one other thing they didn't mention is we haven't missed a meeting in quite a long time. And that's a testament to all of you being committed as volunteers and also committed to the mission, the vision of Magnolia. So I want to thank you. There was a mistake on the governance report, so I did reach out to them to correct it. They stated that Dr. Sakin Cherkhanov had stepped down to become the CFO, which obviously we know it's Sardar Orozov stepped down to become the CFO. So they'll send us an updated report. But for the record, I just want to make sure that that right there is identified and we need to correct it. So with that, any questions on the governance report issued by LACO for MSA 1, 2, 3, and 5? All right, if not, I will turn it over to Sardar to go over the fiscal annual report for our LACO schools.
Hi there, this is Sardar Orozov, and thank you, Alfredo. So as you know, this is an annual report, and you know, this they're using the same template that they used last year. They pretty much go through the budget performance throughout the year. They call out how we performed through the first interim report, second interim report, and they're showing actuals as of May 31. This is important because, you know, you might notice that the numbers they're showing here are not, you know, the same numbers that we have on the unaudited actuals, because those are the actuals as of May 31st. And unaudited actuals were prepared after we closed the year, which is June 30. Other than that, they are calling out, they're noting the related transactions. In our case, it's the, you know, the loans been between the organizations. When I say like from MERV to MSA 1 or from MSA 1 to MSA 5, the loan amount that we just approved last actually board meeting. And then at the bottom of the report, they're showing the financials from last year. And, you know, with just summarizing the numbers in a table below which they actually have the net operating surplus as of May 31st. And then they're showing that we're doing okay in terms of the meeting the current standard 1.0 for the working capital ratio. They're also saying that we're in positive in terms of debt to net assets ratio and calling out the ending fund balance. And that concludes the report. Again, the numbers here in terms of the net operating surplus have changed since the date of this report, but it changed into positive. So we had a couple of schools in negative here in this report because those reports were prepared as of May 31. But as of the year of the year end, June 30, the numbers have improved and we are looking at positive at all sites other than MSA 3. This is briefly about the fiscal part. If you have any questions, I'm happy to address those.
One second. So it shows deficit in all of the three schools, but you completed it positive, right?
Except for MSA 3.
MSA 3, okay.
Yes, MSA 3's net surplus for the year was like a negative. But in terms of the net reserve, yes, we meet all the standards. We don't have any problem. But in terms of the surplus for the year, it was negative. But for all other three schools, MSA 1, 2, and 5, we closed the year in positive.
And how big it was? I don't remember. Do you have the number?
The MSA 3?
Yeah.
Let me actually pull that really quick here.
And my question, would that be a red flag for the renewal, basically?
I think they might note it, but because we have a strong reserve for MSA 3, I don't think it will be a huge problem.
Okay.
Other questions?
Sardar, this is Mekhan. I know that we went over the budget for this coming year. The margins were kind of thin. How do we expect to finish the year, given the numbers? Will we be repeating this, even if the tests are required, or with or without them? How do you project it at this point? I know it's down the road. but do we have contingency kind of not to repeat this?
Yeah, that's a good question. And we're talking about 2021 here. You know, I think we had a discussion about this last time in the last meeting as well. It is, unfortunately, we're going through unprecedented times. I don't want to commit to anything right now. As of right now, we're looking good. But as you all know, we might have additional expenses coming our way. We know that there are testing expenses as a possibility, and we don't know how much extra, you know, spending we'll have due to the COVID-19 reopening efforts and how long this process will go on. So we might probably have a better idea in the coming month, but as of right now, unfortunately, I can't say for sure if we can, you know, commit to the numbers that we actually have in front of us in terms of the 2021 budget.
Got it. Thank you for that, Sardar. Just especially given the importance of MSA3 and the renewables and everything else, keeping us posted would be very much appreciated.
Absolutely. And one thing, you know, just to put some level of comfort there, we're working with the principals very closely. We're monitoring our expenses and we're watching out for anything unexpected coming our way. We're, you know, every single transaction is going by myself, and, you know, we're trying our best not to allow any additional expenses to the extent possible. But again, when it comes to the COVID-19, you know, there's no much wiggle room we have. So it's some things we can have control over, and some we don't. So we're doing our best here to kind of abide by the board approved budgets.
Thank you.
Well, that will turn it over to Erdinç to go over the instructional program.
Yes, thank you, Alfredo. Good evening, board members. This is Erdinç Acar, Chief Academic Officer, and the public schools. In front of you is the last section of the Los Angeles County Office of Education oversight review is the instructional program. Again, the oversight team led by David Downing is in charge of preparing this review, and what LACO does is they not only go documents we submit and give them during the year as part of this oversight and review process. They also come to our school sites in person and interact with our staff, teachers, observe classrooms, notes. And then compare with their notes and our programs and come back and prepare this detailed review. Instruction program review has five areas, and those are educational programs, services to special populations, curriculum materials, and teacher qualifications, our ongoing assessments, and then finally the facilities and operations. So all of our four schools, they receive detailed analysis under these areas, including, you know, several checked. We have to see the reports very positive, you know, greatly reflecting what we do in terms of our program services to our students' families. And then we're happy that the LACO staff captured what we do as Magnolia Public Schools in our schools. So you do have summaries of those reports, as David said, highlighted in front of you. You also have the detailed reports below the document. You probably have reviewed. As summaries, we see that in three of our schools, as we know, they are going to get through the renewal cycle in the 2021-22 school year, that they are being recommended to get their program data, the assessment data, their outcome data in place, in alignment with the measurable outcomes and the LCAP goals, So that's the team, and we are prepared nowadays actually for the renewal. So on par with our preparations that is going on. Specific to schools for MSA 1, we see the LACO is recommending also, you know, increasing the pupil outcomes as measured by the assessment data. For our school, MSA 2, some recommendations are in line with our programs offering in STEAM and CTE, Career Technical Education, that the school has been working on improving the college career pathways and the partnerships and the offerings. And for our school, MSA 3, it's recommended that the school with the new leadership and staff strengthening the ties with the community, the staff, parents. And then for our school, MSA 5 is the recommendation goes as to increase the, improve the high school programs in terms of, again, you know, with a small graduating class last year and now becoming a bigger high school, increasing the dual enrollment partnerships and university college connectedness. So these are the summaries and the recommendations highlighted by the LACO. And we again thank the team over there and our teams at school for producing great results on par with our charters programs. And we look forward, you know, continuing partnership with LACO and their teams as well. Any questions at this point? If not, I'll turn it to David Yilmaz to conclude this item.
David, can I respond to this? Sure. Can I respond to sure. Mr. Yafanel's question? The ending balance, or not ending balance, the net surplus for the year 1920 for MSA 3 is actually -$253,000. And the net, like the projected ending balance, like reserves, is $794,000.
Okay. Thank you for the follow up.
No problem.
So this concludes our presentation, unless there are other questions from the board members or the public.
All right, before any final thoughts from the board, are there any public comments? No? Any final thoughts from our board members? All right, thank you. So this is a discussion item, so it does not require any actions. Next on the agenda, we have item 3B, MPS suspension expulsion procedure. Dr. Lopez, Director of Student Services, will be presenting this item. Dr. Lopez?
Hello, good afternoon, everyone. Good afternoon, well, it's evening. Good evening, board members, Magnolia team members, and guests on the call. Tonight, I am tasked with presenting to you a refresher on the suspension and expulsion policy and procedures as requested by the LACO oversight report. I wanted to, before we jump into the procedures, especially discussing due process rights for students and parents, I wanted to do a quick flashback looking at the PowerPoint. So Jennifer, if you can project the PowerPoint for everyone to see.
Russell, scroll down. There you go.
Thank you. So I wanted to do a flashback to 2 years ago when I was in front of the board, board members at the time, 2 years ago, as the new Assistant Director of Student Services. And I was tasked with overseeing student discipline and, most importantly, focusing on how to decrease our suspension or expulsion rates. At that time, I also gave you a brief overview of our procedures and our policies, as well as our goals. So now, moving ahead 2 years, I again present to you what started off that conversation in terms of disproportionality on a national level. So here are some incidents when it comes to disproportionality on discipline and suspensions based on race and gender and ethnicity. So I won't go over each of these, but this was shared with the board ahead of time, the PowerPoint. But just to point out some stark statistics, it's Black students are 3.8 times more likely to be suspended than white students. Black girls are 6 times more likely to be suspended than white girls. And Latino students represent 21% of suspensions and 25% of expulsions. Looking at these statistics, again, at a national level, and then we go to state. So if you can continue to scroll up, please. Razul or whoever has control, thank you. In California, continuing to see these statistics, the statewide suspension rate for Black males is 3.6 times greater than that of statewide rate for all students. And so as we looked at this information, jumping into our own data, and you can continue to scroll up, we see that 2 years ago, 2017, 2018, our out-of-school suspensions, although there wasn't so much disproportionality, but there were very high rates. And so we had 60 out-of-school suspensions at that time. In-school suspensions, we had 31. So as a reminder, in-school suspensions are when they are in school, but they are not in the classroom. Expulsions, we had 2. In 2018, 2019, the year I joined the team at the home office level, we did see there were some growing pains in that time where we were working to implement intervention strategies, working with different team members, some new team members at some of our school sites, and this is Magnolia-wide. And we had 73 out-of-school suspensions, but we did drop our in-school suspensions to 8 and expulsions to 3. And last school year, we were able to, MPS-wide, drop our out-of-school suspensions to 29 out-of-school suspensions, in-school suspensions 3, and only one only one expulsion that was communicated to the board. So this is definitely, these last numbers really represent the tremendous work that our organization has been doing to focus on looking at the whole child and supporting the whole child, the whole student, and as well as partnering with the community, partnering with supports, leveraging trust with their families to make sure that we are not just addressing the behavior in the now, but also in the future. And so with that, looking at our promising practices moving forward, what's contributed to these suspension rates before I jump into the procedures is, thank you so much. Really focusing on this tiered intervention. And so when you look at this visual here with the triangles, you see that when we address behavior incidents with a universal approach, that universal approach can be greeting students on a daily, knowing their names, making sure that the structured environment that they're in, discussing expected behaviors prior to them entering the classroom. Now it's a little different, it's distance learning. So we have to make sure that we carry those promising practices into our distance learning environment. And when you look at this triangle, the reason it looks like it's laying on top of each other is that the universal, we continue to apply those approaches even as we loop in more support. So after universal approaches, if they're not working, the students continuing to demonstrate undesired behaviors, then we would loop in tier 2 interventions, which might be a check-in, check-out, partnering with the mentor, possibly setting them up with a group session to support in, a workshop with anger management, depending on what the issue might be. And then we would then continue to support the students who need that tier 3 supports. So really looking at the depth of layered interventions, as well as focusing on with multi-tiered systems of support, we have positive behavior interventions, restorative practices, and looking at the social emotional learning and development of our students. So moving ahead, you can scroll up. We also took a research-based approach in that we understand that every behavior communicates something. And teaching all of our adults, all of our staff that work with students, that that behavior is communicating something. What is it and how can we address it? Instead of looking at it like, why is a student acting that way? What could have happened to the student or what happened that had this student act this way and how can we can address it? Another thing we want to keep in mind is self-care.
I hope we get her back.
Did the baby do something? I think baby.
She's back on.
Okay.
Sorry about that. I have a 3-year-old, so life happens, right? Okay. So, again, this is why it's important. So what happened, right? Right now, this is what happened. My child needed their basic needs met, just like some of our students need their basic needs met. And if they're communicating to us that they need basic needs met, we approach it with a strategy like HALT, right? So are you hungry? Are you angry? Are you lonely? Are you tired? Before we jump into a knee-jerk reaction and punishment. We don't want to go there. We want to make sure we address what's going on in the immediate. And resilience, promoting resiliency with strength-based focus, making sure that we understand everyone comes with strengths and leveraging that and really helping the child develop those skills, further develop them. You can scroll up. So I'm gonna, I don't know if I'm allowed to pause within presentation before I jump into the procedures, but there is a lot that I kind of just shared with you. But with the suspension offenses and procedures. So now when we're looking at these procedures, looking at, again, it's in our student parent handbook. You can easily access that. We share that with all of our stakeholders through via distance learning. We've shared it through Parent Square. Parent Square allows us to share it with all stakeholders and they have access to all of our policies. You'll find in there the non-discretionary mandatory suspension offenses, what those categories might be. And then we have our suspension procedures. Most importantly, with due process, we have a conference that needs to take place. So if there is an incident that resulted in the need to suspend, so if it was the top five are, you know, if there's a weapon that was brought to school or sexual battery or sexual assault, sexual harassment, anything that really puts the school students in danger, and the leader, the school leader, the principal deems that there needs to be a suspension, there would first be a conference with the student and the parent. Then there would be a written notice to the parent guardian, letting them know this is what the suspension is for how long and when the student is allowed to come back. It also states that there's an appeal process there. There must be instructional support provided when the student has to is not allowed to be at school, so making sure that they have access to learning and they have the opportunity to submit those assignments. That was newly put into place, new legislation for this school year, but it was something that Magnolia was already doing ahead of time because we understand the value of learning, even if there is corrective action that needs to take place. And then if a parent decides to appeal a suspension, they can appeal it, and they would do that in writing to the reflection committee. The reflection committee would either uphold the suspension or determine the suspension is overturned. So that is a final decision from the reflection committee. And then you will also find the suspension time limits and recommendation for expulsion. And the page numbers are listed there. You can scroll to the next slide. Okay. So for expulsion offenses and procedures, you will find the page numbers listed there. But just so you know, there again, there is discretionary. So it's the discretion of the school principal, whether or not there will be an expulsion. And then there is non-discretionary expellable offenses. And for non-discretionary, there is a requirement for an expulsion to be recommended. And again, it's those top five that if a student is putting in danger other students at a great cost at the schools, then it would be a mandatory expulsion recommendation. So for expulsion procedures, the recommendation for expulsion would be made by the principal. The principal is the only one that can make that recommendation at the school site level. A notice to the guardian would take place. An expulsion hearing would be scheduled, and that would be led by the administration panel that would be selected by myself with the authority of our board. A record of expulsion hearing would be taken, and then the presentation of evidence during the hearing would take place. At the conclusion of that, depending on what the decision is, if it is to expel, then the written notice to expel will be delivered to the parent in writing, and it will be added to disciplinary record of the student. Expulsion appeals, so I will mention at this, once there is an expulsion appeal, that is where the board's involvement comes in. We will discuss interim placement, where the student will be during this time, and then following their expulsion from our school, if they are expelled from our school, we usually work with the district of residence for that. We must inform their district of residence that the child has been expelled from our school, and there will be a rehabilitation plan in place if the student is expelled. And then we have special procedures for consideration of suspension, expulsion, or involuntary removal of students with disabilities. This is something we take very seriously when it comes to the safeguards in place and making sure that our students' rights who have special needs are not violated, and taking into account also students who have liaisons that can represent them as well and looping them in. Go to the last slide. You can scroll up. Okay, so with the board involvement, expulsion appeals, this is the only item that has changed for board appeals when it comes to the calendar time. So in order to appeal an expulsion, the student, parent, guardian must submit a written appeal to the CEO or MPS outlining the reason for the appeal, attaching any supporting documentation within 10 calendar days of being informed of the expulsion. In response to the written request of an appeal, the CEO or Magnolia Public Schools shall call a meeting of the board of directors. The board shall convene a hearing on the appeal within 30 calendar days of a receipt of a timely written request of an appeal. So previously that was a shorter window. We were able to make sure that it's a reasonable time, 30 days to make sure that we have the appropriate documentation that parent would need to provide and that the board can appropriately review before they make a decision. At the hearing on the appeal, the student shall have the right to present evidence. The board will consider evidence and or testimony as appropriate and will render a written decision that shall be in the best interest of the student and Magnolia Public Schools. That decision shall be final. And you can scroll to the last one. Thank you. So looking ahead, with all the information I've provided, our goals moving forward, and I discussed this with our Dean of Students just today, making sure that if they had any last minute items we wanted to add today as I presented this to the board, we want to continue to build on promising practices and leverage trust with stakeholders related to the overall health and safety of our students, remembering that nothing should be about us without us when it comes to our students. Making sure they have voice and choice in these restorative practices and positive behavior interventions. Refine a structured approach to tracking supports and data. It's an iterative process, so making sure that we have our structures in place that will be sustained over time. And then having sustainable multi-tiered systems of support, positive behavior interventions, and restorative justice practices. Research-based approach to addressing student behavior conduct. This year, implementing the zones of regulation, which is the social-emotional learning curriculum that helped our students in developing self-awareness and emotional regulation and emotional awareness. Shifting the mindset of adults and children is our major focus. So with that, that concludes my presentation to the board. If you have questions, I'm glad to answer them.
Before the board addresses any comments or questions, is there any comments from the public?
I will say that since things have improved so much, I'm glad to have this historical knowledge. I hope we don't have to use it at all. Thank you.
Thank you.
Perfect. No other comments or questions from the board? Alrighty. So once again, this is a discussion item. No further action is needed for this. So now we have item 3C, enrollment update. Our CEO and superintendent, Mr. Rubalcaba, will be discussing this item.
Yes, thank you, Jennifer. Again, Alfredo Rubalcaba, CEO, superintendent. So what you have before you here is Census Day enrollment. Obviously, this year it has a different significance, but what's important to understand is last year when we did have Census Day, which was the first week of October 2019, we had 3,892 students. And then when we ended the year, which was our P2 count, we had about 3,855. Currently, right now, officially, we have 3,873. We did have two students enroll to Santa Ana, so 3,873. So compared to last year, that is 19 students less. Compared to the end of last year, it is more students. This year, it is specific to two sites where obviously we did not meet expectations. So just to go through each site, so MSA 1 did meet the expectation. We did project 700 students and we ended up getting 717. And I believe if we didn't have the pandemic, we probably would have had close to 800 students. MSA 2 also did very well. We were projecting 437, which was their count the last 2 years, and we ended up with 463. And I just want to focus on MSA 5 and 7. So 5 as well has been trending for 3 years now, and this year we do have 8 more students than last year. And then 7, we've always had 292, but we did have 294. And I think what's remarkable about that, there was another charter school that did open up very close to MSA 7, but because of some of the work they've been doing, we were able to have 294. So when I talk about patterns, something about that enclave of MSA 1, 2, 5, and 7, definitely there was quite a bit of demand. So that's something, again, that we're looking at different factors to see what contributed to that, specific to Reseda, specific to the surrounding areas, specific to some of the programmatic features, because across the board, most of the schools had the same features. So looking at that, MSA 4 and 6 statistically stayed the same as last year, dropped by 3 or 4 students, which again, historically, we've seen some major drops at MSA 4 and 6 because of quite a bit of our families moving out from that area. For MSA 8, so 8 and MSA 3 are the two school sites where we did see a dip. And for MSA 8, we did do a little bit further analysis, and the other two school sites that do share the same facilities also lost 30 to 50 students. So I do believe there, when we do, you know, finalize, look at everything, look at other the sites, it is going to be something specific to people moving out of the area and mobility, and then also people staying in the sixth grade. But again, that is 42 students less than last year. And then MSA 3 is about 80 students less than last year. And with MSA 3, obviously looking at the middle school to see how many students they projected, and we'll see that through Census Day, and then some of the local schools comparisons, because With MSA 3 is a little tougher because we do have our students coming from different zip codes that are as far as 8 to 10 miles away. So we'll look at that. So then the question becomes, what is the best strategy now with COVID? So besides some of the partnerships we'll have with third-party providers for MSA 8 and 3, it still does come down to parents as our ambassadors, parents as our critical partners in this piece, and making sure that we're always, always doing what's best for kids and families by providing a quality education, first and foremost, and then through multiple meetings, which all of our schools have done, but MSA 3 and 8, we are pushing for those meetings to happen more frequently. After you present, obviously, a good program, then you have to obviously get the parents to start, you know, participating and being a part of that. And they will be our ambassadors, not only in helping us to get resources, but also word of mouth, letting other families know about the great program. So that's what we expect to do specifically more at three, given that we do have Zeke, our new leader. So building out some structures with our parents and obviously with the academic program, you know, continuing to strengthen that, not only at the middle school, high school level. So those two pieces together, again, by the end of the year should benefit us in a positive way. I don't believe we will ever reach the 485, 490, 495 within the next 2 years. But definitely I do see that we can make some progress to next year be closer to what our petition indicates, about 450, 460. So those are things we're aiming for. And then Bell, honestly, with Bell, it is going to come down to being innovative and also making sure that we're always constantly thinking about how do we approach the community in terms of what are the other schools doing, how do we measure up to that, and how do we go above and beyond that, because it is a very competitive city. And again, we would have to just look at the mobility, because when Jason did tell me quite a bit of parents moved out from the other schools, I do know that's an issue. But we are learning how to do this under COVID. Obviously, the major districts like LAUSD, San Diego Unified, Santa Ana Unified all did have enrollment declines, mostly in elementary. But we know that some of the families that we typically serve, you know, might have moved to other areas or there had to be some mobility. So all that is difficult to analyze, but I think most importantly is building, continuing to strengthen the structures academically, the programs being strong, which we feel we've done, and then definitely creating the parent structures and building off of that, because those parents are our ambassadors. So that's kind of in a nutshell where we're at with enrollment. How does that impact us from a financial standpoint? As all of you are aware, because of SB 98, all the schools are held harmless, which means they get the funding based on the P2 count to 2019, right? P2 count. And that P2 count in totality was about 3,850 something students. So that right there, we'll get paid that money. So for instance, for MSA 3, although they have 417 students, they are getting funded for 483. Similar MSA 4, although they have 100, then we're going to get funded for 131. And with 4 and 6, we will definitely bring the merger petition to the LAUSD board at the right time, which should be soon. So then we could merge those two schools. So going back to funding, we are protected for this year. And then also now with SB 820, now we have further guidance from the CDE on how we could get funding for the extra students that reflect growth for MSA 1, which is would be from the 650 students they had last year to the 700 that are reflected in the budget, which was the June 29th budget. So the rules were in SB 820 are a little somewhat unfair, but the way it would work is whatever we budgeted at that June 29th meeting for the schools, that number would be you know, we would subtract the number of students they had last year in P2 count. So for MSA 1, about 50 some students. MSA 2, unfortunately, although they grew, we didn't expect the growth. So when we did have the board approve the budget, we did have 437, so we would not get money for their growth, unfortunately, for this year and how the statute was written. For MSA 6, we would get extra money because we did have 130-some students in P2 count, and now with them having 163, we'll get extra money. And then for the other schools, San Diego, Santa Ana are pretty much the same where they were at last year. San Diego was at 444 last year, census day, 442, and then Santa Ana with the two new students, 544. Last year they were at 544, so no decline. So three schools will have to apply for growth money, and that guidance has come out. We have to apply by November 6th, and then that money would be issued to us, which means we would obviously get that money, I believe, the new year, and then strategically use that money to help the schools. So with that, open it up to any questions.
Alrighty, are there any public comments or questions? No, any comments or questions from the board?
Alfredo, this is Mia Khan. What is our capacity at MSA 1? Like when we are at full capacity, or are we at above what we can accommodate there?
Yeah, so we initially in our petition, we did indicate that we could fit 885 students. Based on what we saw last year, there was definitely quite a bit of space for high schoolers. So I think this year, I think it not until we get to see the students in the classes, and obviously we won't see the entirety of the group, but I do believe it's somewhere between 800, 830, 840. But again, we'll see. But I think the big piece with MSA 1 that we still have to work on is to get them an outdoor space. And I know Patrick and the team were working on something to bring to the board on how we could do that. And we're meeting with Mustafa on a weekly basis. But with MSA 1 currently as structured, I believe somewhere between 8 and 8:30, if we do add an outside space, a playground or play area, then I do believe we could meet the 885 number that's reflected on the petition and probably a little more students. So that's in essence kind of how I see it.
Okay, great. Sounds great. And also, you did mention MSA 8 is kind of becoming our priority now, right, in terms of number of students. We know where that school was and where it can get to. And these are, I mean, to say the least, alarming numbers, but they are your priority, obviously. So that's my comment on it, and you are well aware.
Yeah, and with Bell, it has become more competitive since I was there, yes. Because there's KIPP. There's a KIPP yes. school that did come into that territory, and they're K through 8. And then they also open up Mesa's, which is accelerated. So the competition is there, but I do believe that there was a time that we were up and above, you know, above shoulders when it comes compared to the other two schools. So I think there are ways for us to you know, work with the families in that community to then get the students from the two other schools. And I think it ultimately comes down to the parents understanding that, you know, we are a tier above that school. So there's a way there for us to reach the 495, 496 number we had for 3 years in 2014, 15, and 16. That's going to be difficult, but I do think there's still room for us to be somewhere at the 470, 475, but we have our work cut out.
Thank you.
Welcome.
Any other questions or comments from the board? No? Okay. Well, this is also a discussion item, so it does not require any further action. And with that, that's the end of our agenda. Rabbi
Before we convene, I just want to, one thing I forgot to mention at the beginning, and I'm going to pinch myself, but I did want to thank one of our board members. I'm not going to say who, but one of our board members did contribute to one of our schools, and that contribution was matched by their company. Again, going through the difficult times we are, any contribution does help. So I do want to acknowledge our board member and thank him for his contribution. And obviously working with Ismael and the board, you know, our goal is a very lofty one, but we will continue to work hard to get more money for our students and communities. So just wanted to put that on the record and thank our board member. Turn it over back to you, Jennifer.
Thank you. We have really great board members. Rabbi Belia, may you please adjourn the meeting. The time is 7:29 p.m.
I'd just like to mention that there's an election coming up, and specifically, I think Proposition 15 is something that we have talked about as benefiting education in general. And at some point, Alfredo shared with me the potential benefit that we would receive, and maybe you could just review that before we announce the adjournment.
Yeah, with Prop 15, for those of you that are not familiar, it goes back to a law that was enacted, Prop 13 in 1978, that treated how businesses or commercial and industrial buildings or properties were taxed versus residentials. So at that time, it was determined that everyone would be taxed accordingly. And once you were taxed, that would stay stagnant with no reevaluation. So with Prop 15, that is trying to be modified where you would then tax businesses, commercial and industrial properties. So that extra money that they would be taxed at their market rate would create quite a surplus of money. And of that money, about 15 billion would be allocated to schools, but this allocation wouldn't happen until the 2025-2026 school year. So with that, obviously November 3rd, if that proposition does pass, then obviously that you're talking about an influx of funding in 2025-2026. Currently that, that proposition, according to the Public Policy Institute of California that does random polling throughout the year, as of 2 weeks ago, does have that proposition up by 51%. So I just want to urge the board members and community members to be well-versed in the proposition, specifically this one, and then, you know, vote. So with that, I will just turn it over to Dr. Rabbi.
Thank you for the promotion. I'd like to thank everyone for participating in today's meeting. I would also like to note that we're concluding our meeting in a record time, thank all the staff and board members who participated. We are adjourned.
Have a good night, everyone. Thank you.
Have a good evening. Bye-bye.
Bye. Good night, everyone. Bye.